Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in History. My name is Peter Christian Agner, your host. Today, we'll be talking to Terry Galway about his new book, Machine Made, Tammany Hall and the Creation of Modern American Politics. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being on. It was a pleasure reading your book. As I was just saying, last week we were talking with Mason Williams about the great anti-Tammany crusader, Fiore LaGuardia. Your book takes a bit of a different approach. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got to the project?
Well, sure. I'm a professor, assistant professor of history at Kane University in New Jersey, sort of a late in life PhD. I got my degree in 2012 in my late 50s. This book was really an outgrowth of my dissertation research. I've always been interested in Tammany Hall, mainly because I've always been interested in New York politics. I grew up on Staten Island in the 1960s and 70s, when Tammany was, you know, dead and buried. Grew up in an Irish Catholic household where, you know, the names of people like Al Smith were revered. And, later on in life, in the late 70s and 80s, I was lucky enough to become a political reporter in New York and then through the 1990s. So I've always had this fascination for New York politics. And when it came time to choose a dissertation topic, I had been thinking a lot about Tammany and thinking that surely its negative reputation was so deeply felt, the reporter in me decided, well, you know what, it has to be more complicated than that. So I sort of began to become skeptical, frankly, of the LaGuardias of the world and their worldview of what Tammany was about, and reading some of the what I think were very preachy and almost hysterically anti-Tammany histories that were out there. That's what led me to believe that there was another side to the story and it hadn't been told. And so I did that as my dissertation and sort of rewrote it quite a bit, and it was published by Norton, and it's out there now, and other historians are welcome to tear it apart, although I'd rather they didn't, but it's out there for as a countervailing view to what most people feel about Tammany Hall.
Right. Well, you make the point that Tammany was more than just a corrupt organization in a corrupt era in one city during the nation's history, that it became a national symbol for urban government and beyond that, all that urban government stood for. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be talking with Steve Kahn, who just wrote a wonderful new book on the anti-urban tradition in America, which is deep and wide and old. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this caricature of Tammany or what Tammany as a symbol meant?
Well, I mean, as a symbol, Tammany was perceived not just in New York, as you suggest, but it was a national symbol of corrupt government. Now, what did corruption mean? Well, it meant, graft, of course. It meant patronage. It meant inefficiency. It meant friends helping friends. It meant hiring people who were unqualified, padding the payroll, etc. And of course, Tammany was responsible for all of those things. I mean, particularly, of course, the face of Tammany Hall, the person that most people associate with Tammany Hall was Boss Tweed, who was the head of this organization, which really, Tammany Hall is sort of shorthand for the Democratic Party in Manhattan. Tweed is the poster boy of urban corruption. Well, Tweed was the boss of Tammany Hall for just a couple of years during the Civil War and during Reconstruction, and he's overthrown by 1871. Meanwhile, the longest reigning boss of Tammany Hall, and mind you, a boss of this organization is unelected, except actually not elected by the populace or even the Democratic voters, but chosen by the party. He's basically the party chairman. Well, the longest serving boss of Tammany was this guy named Charles Francis Murphy, served from 1902 to 1924. He's the guy who mentored Al Smith and Robert Wagner, two of the great liberals in New York history. Smith is arguably the greatest governor New York has ever had. Wagner, arguably one of the greatest senators New York has ever had. And that's saying something, because New York's had an awfully large number of good senators. So I think that, this idea that, Tammany, as you suggest, Tammany also stood for government in cities. And if you read the critics of the time, there was this real anti-urban bias in a lot of the criticism of Tammany. There was a lot of anti-immigrant bias. There was a lot of anti-poor bias. And there was a lot of anti-Catholic, anti-Irish bias. So to me, Tammany came to stand for not just bad government and corrupt government. Tammany came to stand for government by strangers, government by people who aren't really Americans, government by people who had hyphens in their identities, as if Anglo-Saxon was not hyphenated. So the hysteria over Tammany, I think, was a product of demographic change in the United States. It was and it stood for government by others. And I think that accounts for the over-the-top criticism that you see of Tammany in newspapers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Yes. That's very interesting. And I think it's maybe important we should talk a little bit more about, you make get our sort of basics down here, talking about patronage and things like that. Tammany is also an institution that, like a lot of the machines, is not quite aligned with, the press is very anti-machine. The press also sort of represents different institutions in the society, right? And where Tammany is sort of seen culturally aligned with these immigrants and these workers. You talk about Murphy and Al Smith, and these people are, Smith is the one who begins the New Deal realignment, by bringing in these immigrants and workers and people that have felt excluded from the political process.
Absolutely. And there was a time in New York history where immigrants were coming in by the tens of thousands every month. And that was the Irish famine from 1845 to 1851. Before that, no one would have ever necessarily described New York as a city of immigrants. It certainly was a diverse city, much more so, say, than Boston or Chicago. New York, by its, even under the Dutch, New York was a diverse kind of city. So as these immigrants are coming in, they are poor. Many of them, contrary to what people think, many of them didn't speak English. They spoke Irish. They had nothing but the shirts on the back. They had just fled a country in which the choice was you either leave or you starve to death. So these were immigrants unlike any other immigrants who had come into New York, and they were Catholic. So they were despised, and it led to the nativist Know-Nothing movement of the 1850s. And the nativist movement was supported by the main opposition party at the time, the Whig Party. And then when the Whig Party disappeared, the Republican Party picked up this nativist streak. Well, the Democratic Party under Tammany chose another way of dealing with these immigrants. They said, basically, we're going to help them, and they're going to repay us with their votes. It's a very simple calculation. We're talking about brass knuckle, practical politics here. You do something for me, I'll do something for you. I know people are shocked when they discover that politics can work that way, but
yeah,
it does. And it does today. And it was Ronald Reagan who ran for president in 1980 by asking the following question: are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And people said, no, we're not better off. We want to be better off, so we're going to vote for this guy. Well, that's what the immigrants said. We want to be better off. Who is helping us? Well,
Well, that's a
Tammany
very,
was.
yeah, it's a very interesting notion because it you know, in many ways cuts against this belief that we have about our system or what our system should be. You know, you talk about in the early parts of your book, you talk about how Tammany, you talk about what you think Tammany brought to modern politics. And, you know, the early vision of the people who were in charge, the minority of people who were in charge in the days of the early republic, had this vision of America as a republic, and what a republic was supposed to be was this place of, you use the phrase, dispassionate analysis and objective disinterest. You know, the founders in the Federalist Papers, you read that you know, parties are not supposed to, parties are factions, and factions are evil, and the pursuit of self-interest, which is, you know, what else is democracy but interest groups jockeying for representation of their interests, right?
Exactly.
And yet there's this feeling that that's crass, it's selfish, it's not the way politics is or should be, when in fact it's arguably always been that way.
You know, I'm reminded, as you were speaking, I was reminded of a great scene in a William Kennedy novel called Roscoe, in which he's dealing with the Albany machine, which, of course, is not Tammany. In fact, the Tammany and the Albany machine sometimes didn't get along, but it was sort of a miniature version of Tammany. It was certainly Irish-controlled. But the main figure in the novel, Roscoe, who is a, you know, sort of a local power broker, a ward healer, one might say. At one point, Kennedy has him in a soliloquy, and he's in essence saying, you know, I know all of these ideals. I know that, you know, politics is supposed to be moral, and I'm looking around for all that morality, and I just don't see it. And he's meaning that not as a criticism of his fellow party members. He's looking at the businessmen. He's looking at you know, the elites too, and the way they operate in and around Albany. And he's looking for this great ideal republic of disinterest, and he doesn't see it.
Right.
So I think that Tammany also, not too many people, not many Tammany people read the Federalist Papers, I'm sure. And
Right.
I'll confess that I have not read them all. But I know this ideal republic that Alexander Hamilton and others envisioned, and yeah, that's nice. But you know, Tammany had to deal with the real problems of real people at a time when if you were unemployed, you starved. If you starved, you probably died. If you were a father and you died, you left behind a family, that family might get split up by private charities because that's the only charity there was. There was nothing resembling the social welfare system that we have today. It was all about rugged individualism, one of the founding myths of the republic, that you know, we can all basically pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Well, Robert Wagner, a proud son of Tammany Hall, you know, addressed that once in speaking with a friend of his. He said, you know, we have this myth that you know, through hard work, you can make something of yourself merely through applying yourself and through hard work. And he told the friend, you know, that's bunk. He said, for every one person who does pull themselves up, 1,000 are destroyed. And
Right.
now that might be a slight exaggeration, but you get Wagner's point. And I think that that also was very much an ethos at Tammany, is that, okay, yeah, there are people who are going to make something of themselves, but what about those who cannot?
Yeah. Well, it's I have read the Federalist Papers. I've written a little bit about the Federalist Papers, and we have this notion that these are sort of highly realistic documents, but they're creatures of their time, however democratic they were in their time. And there's a slight sort of utopian streak to that. I mean, so I'm taken by this argument. I mean, it's also, I think, something that, you know, it's not just about these corporate elites or other people, but we want our own interests represented in government, right? And this is your point about Tammany, that you know, the subtitle of your book, The Creation of Modern American Politics, you argue that Tammany prepared the way for modern liberalism by encouraging people to look to accessible political figures for protection from laissez-faire capitalism and protection from the contempt of moral reformers who were often, you know, of a different socioeconomic caste, who were really trying to regulate the poor, and Saw the Poor. You have this section where you talk about, you know, the very familiar language, you know, that Catholics were seen as poor in their day because they were lazy, and they were lazy because they were because of their culture, and their culture was shaped by their religion, their Catholicism, mm-hmm. and this would explain their situation. And in the view of Thomas Malthus and these other classical liberal economists, if they just, you know, if they just pull themselves up by their bootstrap, none of that would be the case.
That's right. So, and Tammany was not in the business of judging people's morals. One of the characters who I wished I'd been able to make a bigger character in my book, Big Tim Sullivan, because he's an interesting guy. Big Tim Sullivan was a product of Irish poverty, Irish-American poverty, and in the five-point section, his parents, I believe, were famine immigrants, but perhaps not. I could be misremembering. But in any case, he grew up poor. One of his memories is that he never had any shoes. And every year at his clubhouse, once a year was shoe giveaway day, where he literally would give away shoes to anybody who came along. And he once said that, I don't see, his almost an exact quote, I don't feed a man because he is good. I feed a man because he's hungry, you know? And that's sort of approach to giving out charity, if you will, or giving out government entitlements, was very opposite to the kinds of charity that most poor people had to subject themselves to in the 19th century, where you had somebody literally judging whether you were worthy or not of assistance. And if you would and if that person, that visitor, as often they were called, if that visitor decided that, you know what, you know, you drink too much, so you're not getting aid, well, then you didn't get aid.
Yeah, Walter Trattner and Michael Katz and other folks have written very well on this, these very ancient notion that's usually tied up with a severe form of Protestantism about the deserving and the undeserving poor.
Exactly.
And most tended to fall in the latter category.
Yes.
So why don't we start rolling through these chapters here and talking about the early days, the arrival of the Irish. I mean, Tammany exists. The as you said before, Tammany is the there's the Tammany Society and Tammany Hall,
mm-hmm.
and Tammany essentially is the Democratic Party in New York or Manhattan, very important in the city, the most important machine, and or in the post unification days,
mm-hmm.
When the Irish show up, Tammany is not the Tammany that we know, right? So could you talk a little bit about that story?
Well, sure. I mean, Tammany, before the Irish famine immigration of the 1840s, some Tammany figures even kind of were nativist. Tammany,
yeah,
in its early days, was an organization of native-born Protestants. It was not the immigration-loving institution that it became. It was, at its roots, it was a private social club was founded in the early days of the Republic. It was sort of transformed by Aaron Burr and others into a political voting bloc. So this private organization called the Society of St. Tammany, named after a Native American, in essence took over the Democratic Party in New York, was not a dominant faction in the 1830s or so, but by the time the Civil War came around, Tammany was pretty much ensconced in power, and the Democratic Party was ensconced in power in New York as a result of its willingness to deal with these hundreds of thousands of immigrants, as opposed to the Whig and then Republican strategy of rejecting them and ostracizing them, and in fact denying their ability to participate in the American experiment. I mean, they felt that these Catholics were simply incapable of understanding Protestant ideas of liberty. And, you know, as you know, the American political discourse at the time was very much, religion was very much a part of it, as one would argue it is today. And back then, many people in authority thought of American concepts, not as secular, but actually as laden with Protestant values. And Catholics, never mind Jews or Muslims or anyone, they simply couldn't understand them. So that was the attitude that the nativists had for the Catholics, and the Democrats in Tammany said, well, you know what? As I said before, if we are welcoming to them, and you know whether they were doing this out of the goodness of their hearts or whether they were calculating, it doesn't matter. I don't think anyway. What matters is that people who needed help got help, and what a surprise! They then rewarded their helpers with votes on election day. Again, people are shocked by this, but to me, I'm not so shocked.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you talk about this as a new social contract. Following the logic that you want your representatives in government to represent your interests, when they reward your vote with things,
right,
with some form of welfare, whatever form that takes. That's essentially what we're saying we want our system to do, right?
Right, right. And it's challenging the idea that there is this notion of disinterest, because this notion of disinterest is being held mostly by civic elites who I think probably really did believe that they came around to their political views because that they were so smart and so wealthy that they could put – that they didn't have interests,
right,
because they already established.
Right.
But not realizing, as perhaps most of us would realize, that of course they had interests, and that they were in their mind, the common good and their interests just happened to coincide.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So you have this other very interesting argument that struck me. You talk about how the famine was something that had, I believe that, I've read references to studies on this. I think you're on pretty firm footing here that the famine had a generations long impact on thinking. You write that it even for the Irish or Catholics who had never set foot in these Catholic lands, it gave a political and cultural framework to interpret power, specifically in New York and maybe beyond. The famine, you talk about the sort of transatlantic phenomenon challenging this other transatlantic narrative out there, this Anglo-Saxon narrative about republicanism and what government should be and who was capable of participating in government, right? This view that's held as much by the founding elite in the United States as abroad. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, the famine, for those who don't realize the centrality of the famine, or who've heard about it but really don't know anything about it, I mean, the famine, the poor Irish, and most of them were Catholic. Remember, they've had their lands dispossessed by the English settlers, most of whom are Protestant. But the vast majority of the island, 91% of its 8 million people, are Catholic. Most of them have been, as I said, dispossessed. They work as tenant farmers or laborers, and all they really have is potatoes. I mean, that is, it's stereotyped, but it's also amazing to consider that the average male farm worker in Ireland in 1846 or so ate something like 12 to 13 pounds of potatoes a day. All of the other crops were sent off, exported, or used to pay the rent. But the potatoes were easy to grow, and the population became dependent on them. So when the crop failed in 45 and 46 and 47, people started to die. And meanwhile, food under the principles of free market laissez-faire economics, the food in Ireland was being exported. The British government refused to intervene. They felt, of course, that this would be intervening literally in the laws of God to prevent the market from following its own morals. So, you see, there wasn't a famine in Ireland, even though we all refer to it as a famine. It was actually just a failure of a single crop. So you had this phenomenon of powerless, impoverished people starving to death in a land of plenty. And I'm arguing, and the government then, when they finally, when the government does try to offer assistance, there is, in some cases, private charities, Protestant charities, asking the recipients to convert to Protestantism in order to receive relief. And then there was this idea that the head of British Relief actually said that the problem in Ireland is not starvation, it's the lack of virtue among
right.
the people.
Right.
So the Irish picked up on that. And when they understood that if you are without power, you can starve. And if you starve, you can die. So, you know, in some people, at one point, one of my favorite politicians, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, once said that one of the tragedies of Irish politics, of Irish American politics, was that once the Irish achieved power, that they didn't know what to do with it. And with all due respect to the senator, I disagree with that. Once they achieved power, they had power. And they knew what it was like to be powerless. And achieving power was, in some ways, an end unto itself. Because it, you know, when you didn't have power, you starved.
Right.
They didn't have power in Ireland, and they starved. So I think that, this amazing climb that the Irish make from the ghettos of the Five Points and from, you know, the ghettos of South Boston to positions of political leadership out of the famine generation. I mean, it's not without context. That context being, they knew what it was like to be powerless. They knew what it was like to have their poverty judged as lack of character, and that when they got that power, they were not going to do it that way. So I think that it is impossible to understand Irish machine politics without understanding that it was founded by their experience of powerlessness, hunger, cultural alienation in Ireland, and that was transported on those coffin ships across the Atlantic. And so when they get here and they hear politicians in the States challenging their virtue, saying that they are, you know, alien and can't be absorbed into the culture, you know, condemning them for their religion, they're hearing the same conversation they heard in Ireland. The difference being is that this time there were people who were willing to help them. Who are they? The political machines.
Right. And they're incredibly effective. I got interested in this book because I'm writing, as you know, I'm writing a biography of Moynihan, and my second chapter sort of talks about the bookend to your book in a way. It's the end of Tammany. In writing this chapter about Moynihan and the end of Tammany, I came across Stephen Erie's book of years ago, Rainbow's End.
Yes.
And to your point about the Irish taking power or realizing the importance of power after the famine, Erie says that in his estimation, about a dozen of the 20 largest cities in the north in the later, in the mid-1800s and later 1800s were dominated by the Irish, or that the Irish climbed to power in about a dozen of the 20 largest cities, which is incredibly, and you know, it goes to sort of explaining why so much of your, so much of our association with Tammany and the machines is caught up with the Irish.
Exactly. Well, I think that if people have tried to explain why the Irish succeeded in politics, and Moynihan is brilliant on that topic as well. He sees how he compares how village life in Ireland was similar to the discipline of political life in the United States, and there's a certain amount of stereotyping here that the Irish are gregarious, and of course many of them speak English, but not all of them. And there's a certain sort of Irish style of politics, and I think all of that is true. But I also think that there's a deep burning in the Irish character, a burning for power because of the experience of being without power. And they were without power, really, in British-occupied Ireland. They simply were not going to allow that to happen in the United States. And happily for them, the United States, despite the nativism and despite the prejudice, because of the vote, because of the great leveling effect of the vote, the franchise, the Irish were able to seize power in places where maybe they were not even the majority population. And I think that that's an important aspect of this curious development of the Irish takeover of so many cities. Some people see it, as I said, as some people forget that we're talking about a group that was powerless and that starved, and that they just weren't going to let it happen again.
Right, right. And they're coming here and they're facing, as you said before, not just that we're not just talking about some sort of social prejudice that, you know, is sort of inconvenient. We're talking about, you know, things like property rules that are tied to religion and renunciations of religion in the way that they were in Ireland. And you talk about, you know, the public school debate with Bishop Hughes. Mm-hmm. In that period, the loyalty oaths that DeWitt Clinton and others toppled, which is part of what drew the Irish into politics.
Right. Well, the school wars were really important, and I think this is really one of the first books that sort of ties the school wars in New York of the 1840s and Archbishop Hughes to the Tammany story as well, and that is, in a nutshell, you have these waves of Catholic children coming into New York, and the public school system at the time was very much a Protestant school system, although, again, the people who ran the schools didn't see it that way. They saw themselves as disinterested, etc. But, you know, the Bible that they read was the Protestant Bible, King James Bible. History books were given to students, which contained derogatory phrases about the Irish and about Catholicism. So Bishop Hughes, who was the Catholic Archbishop of the time, actually, you know, intervened in New York politics, ran his own slate of candidates to try to persuade the New York power structure to change their curriculum. And eventually, Hughes gave up and started his own Catholic school system. And then that led to this great system of Catholic social services in New York and elsewhere, Catholic hospitals, Catholic orphanages, sort of a social welfare system that was created by this archbishop. And again, Hughes was trying to mobilize the Irish to vote as a bloc, you know, familiar tactic today as it was back then. But here's the point. When Tammany sees the Irish Catholics voting as a bloc, now there's something they respect. And this occurs all around the same time as the famine. So again, I do think that Tammany's reaction to the waves of Catholic Irish, I don't think, frankly, is coming from some deep well of humanity. It was coming from pure calculation.
Yeah. We talked about some of this transatlanticism. You talk about use Maurice Halbach's idea of collective memory here. And you talk a little bit about Daniel O'Connell, who people might know for the Catholic Emancipation Movement, and how that the Catholic Association that set up in Ireland, right? That the tactics and the sort of informal welfare system that created are directly replicated by Tammany.
Yeah, I was delighted to make that connection too, because again, Moynihan and others have said, and rightfully so, pointed out, first of all, that one of the reasons why the Irish would have succeeded almost right away is because one thing that they did have in Ireland was most had the vote. Most males over the age of 21 did have the vote and did have the experience of mass politics, because there was this guy, Daniel O'Connell, who in the 1920s led a campaign to get Catholics the right to sit in Parliament and have their full civil rights. So, but one of the ways in which the O'Connell and his party operated, and I looked at the records from the 1920s, and I was just 1820s rather, and I was just astonished. So you have these politicians in Ireland, these Catholic politicians, appealing to the poor Catholics, males, to vote for them. Remember, Catholics were not allowed in the House of Commons, but they wanted in, but they needed Catholics to vote for them. So there are these letters to Daniel O'Connell and his aide saying, you know, we've got these Farmer Smith or Farmer O'Brien, you know, would like to vote for us, but he's afraid that if he does, his landlord will evict him. Can we get him some money? Can we get him £5? Can we get him, can we find another place for him? You know, so there's this idea that the vote really is a transaction. And after all, if you are poor, particularly back then with no safety net, but you're in a democratic system, you do have one thing, and you have the vote. And if you use it in a way to better yourself, well, then you're doing what Ronald Reagan encouraged us to do. Is, you know, ask yourself the question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And if you are, you know, if you aren't, then vote for me. Well, that's pretty much what Daniel O'Connell was saying. You know, he understood that the poor person did have this one enormous power that one can have in a democratic party, in a democratic system that is functioning properly, and that is the vote. So there were all of these appeals to O'Connell to give money to people who were going to vote for him. And, you know, so when the Irish came here, that I think was part of the context of how they looked at American democracy.
Yeah. Well, it becomes, you know, for people who maybe hear this term patronage and don't really know what that signifies. I mean, it becomes the backbone to the moral shock of and horror of reformers, the backbone of the machines, because the machines depend on the machines depend on being able to deliver jobs to voters, patronage. And that's not just, you know, you appointing people to your cabinet because they reward you in terms of donations. It's you know, the average voter getting, you know, a job in some capacity in the city with some public works project or something else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's some limits to these sorts of things, which I think you make some reference to, right? I mean, one of the more infamous periods in Tammany history is history in New York is the colored orphan asylum, the draft riots of '63, mm-hmm. And you talk about how Dan O'Connell, who was a great abolitionist, those views didn't quite always translate in the United States, right?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, relations between the Irish and African Americans were, you know, fraught with peril. As you know, what a surprise, frankly. I mean, you know, nothing unique or shocking there. But it is true that their great hero, Daniel O'Connell, was one of the great abolitionists in the Atlantic world in the 1840s. The draft riots are a complicated topic. It's really just just less than a chapter in my book. The draft riots have been covered so well by other historians. But one of the things that I found interesting was that, you know, Tammany's entry into the draft riots, which occur in 1863, when many Irish Americans, Irish immigrants, many of them famine immigrants or children of famine immigrants, rebel against the idea of fighting a war for the emancipation of blacks. Because they themselves feel that they have not been treated well by the United States, and also knowing that people like Teddy Roosevelt's father can buy out of the draft and they can't. So there's a sense that the draft is unfair. The worst urban rioting in New York history takes place between January 13th and January 17th in 1863. Federal troops are march from Gettysburg to New York to put down the rebellion. But also Tammany, Boss Tweed, comes to the fore because Lincoln tells New York, okay, we will suspend the draft, but this is just the suspension. In August, we're going to start it up again, and you guys have to figure out how to do it. Tweed comes up with this brilliant idea to borrow money, for the city to borrow money to pay the $300 fee to get out of the draft for anyone who wants it. It's a very practical and very expensive solution, but it keeps the peace. And when the draft is resumed in August, thanks to this rather brilliant maneuver by Tammany Hall, there are no other draft riots.
Yeah. Well, so since we're talking about Tweed, and he is the most notorious figure in Tammany history, maybe you could tell us a little bit about that and the era after Tweed and Tammany's response to the Gilded Age.
Right. Well, after Tweed, after Tweed is overthrown by Tammany because of his crimes, he's succeeded by the first Irish boss of Tammany Hall, who is a guy called Honest John Kelly, and he got that reputation because he was thought of as a relatively honest public official. And Kelly is the guy who sort of adopts this kind of ward system, very close to home politics. He is a strict disciplinarian. He is the guy who meets with his local officials all the time, develops this system of having members of the party on every block, at every apartment house, and really develops the machine as we have come to know it. And, you know, a great organizer. And, you know, Tammany, as we know it, basically takes form after Tweed, which is sort of interesting since Tweed is often thought of as the quintessential Tammany figure. But in fact, Tammany becomes, you know, the machine that we know of after he is gone. And Kelly, a fairly respectable sort, you know, gets away from the sort of gross corruption of Tweed. In fact, he is, you know, becomes the controller of this of the city, and is very keen on lowering the taxes of the rich. You know, he's very keen on government efficiency. He wants to make sure that government money isn't wasted. He tells one of his allies, Governor Tilden in New York, that he really ought to be careful about how the state spends its money. This is all in reaction to the you know, the gross excesses of Tweed. So he kind of makes Tammany respectable again, and that's kind of one of his great contributions to Tammany history.
This is the sort of the Jeffersonian small government fiscal conservatism, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Carry us through then. So into the Gilded Age. Where does Tammany? How do we sort of understand Tammany within the context of rapid industrialization of New York and the rest of the country?
Well, you know, most people would, I think the stereotype is that, you know, Tammany was part of the Gilded Age, that they were doing the work of the robber barons, that they were in alliance with them. And there's some merit to that. But there's also some correspondence that I found where Kelly's successor, this guy Richard Croker, who was an Irish immigrant, famine immigrant, as a matter of fact. He and his family left Ireland during the famine, where they are siding with railroad workers and other working class people in their disputes with the railway magnates of the time. I mean, I wouldn't say that Tammany was in the forefront of challenging the Gilded Age in ways that social critics like Henry George were, but I think that they did see the inequities. Part of it is because in 1886, for example, Henry George, who, you know, was sort of a tax the rich, you know, 99% of the time, almost won the mayoral election. The guy who came in third was this young guy named Teddy Roosevelt. And Tammany probably stole that election, frankly. But they saw that people were responding to a class-based message during the Gilded Age. And if you look at the candidates Tammany begins to support during the Gilded Age, and if you look at the rhetoric, they begin to become a lot more populist. Not William Jennings Bryan populist, but sort of urban populist. You can see Tammany ever so slowly turning a little to the left. Now, people might have, you know, some people who might be skeptical said they were just sort of doing that to get votes. Well, yeah, but that's kind of what political parties do. They probably still had their alliances with some of the robber barons, but I think that Tammany, I think, was in some cases, in some disputes in New York, were on the side of the workers, you know, which is again a little counterintuitive, but I don't deny that they certainly had their alliances with some of the robber barons of the time as well. And, you know, one would argue that Croker, who was the boss of the time, and he basically made money hand over fist as a result of contracts and things like that, and that he arguably was a robber baron. And there's some merit to that, yes.
But this sort of, you present this as a sort of preparation period into the age of the person we referenced at the beginning of the interview, Charlie Murphy, and the age of Al Smith.
Right. And that's where you see Tammany really change. I mean, Murphy takes over in 1902 and, you know, is a respectable sort. I mean, you know, he cleans up, again, Croker. Tammany goes through periods of excess, and Richard Croker sort of was more on the Boss Tweed end of things. Murphy comes in, he stops the corruption or tries to cut down on the corruption in the police department. He stops Tammany's the interaction that some Tammany people are having with prostitution and things like that. But beginning around 1910, actually it is in 1910, that this dramatic change takes place in Tammany Hall. And that is Charlie Murphy appoints, because he basically controlled the New York delegation, and he names Robert Wagner, who is 33 years old at the time, German immigrant, to be president of the state Senate. And as majority leader in the state assembly, he names 37 or 38-year-old Al Smith, who is a child of the Lower East Side. His father died when he was 13. He had to go out, drop out of grammar school, and was elected to the assembly in 1905 and became a star because he actually read legislation, which, you know, would be a precedent even today. But back then, it was astonishing. So he became a master of the legislative maneuver. He and Wagner both were up from city streets. They understood poverty. They understood the vulnerability of working class families like their own. And as time would prove, they were determined once they got power, they knew what to do with it. They put power on the side of people like themselves. And Murphy allowed that to happen. And I make the argument that the true reformers in New York during the Progressive Era were Tammany Hall politicians. Not an argument you hear a lot in most traditional histories.
Yeah. No, I imagine some people will disagree.
Yes, I think so. And that's okay.
Yeah, but, you know, we were talking before the show about Hollenbach and Joan Weiss and these other scholars who wrote about Wagner and Smith, and you know, it's a truism in historiography that you know, these early urban liberals prepare the way for FDR and the New Deal, which is, you know, considered the, you know, the big bang in American modern political history. That massive shift within the party system, the massive increase in voter turnout, which had dropped by, I think, 40% to 50% after the 1890s. More than half of that comes back with Smith's nomination for the presidency. And, you know, it encourages FDR, who wasn't quite the urban liberal we remember him to be in his early career.
Mm-hmm.
Gives us the New Deal and which was as much Wagner's legacy as anybody else's.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I try to point out in the book is that, you know, yes, Franklin Roosevelt was really, you know, this image we have of him as president was not the image that his Albany colleagues had of him in 1911 and 1912 when he was a member of the state Senate. In fact, Roosevelt, as the Ken Burns documentary recently pointed out, Roosevelt himself, when he was president, looked back in his time in Albany and described himself as a mean cuss. And he was a mean cuss, and he was very unpopular with his colleagues. And he was determined to crush Tammany Hall. But in my book, I argue that by 1918, Roosevelt is coming around to Tammany to become a virtual ally of Tammany Hall. And his biographers, some of them ignore this. Others feel they have to confront the evidence that there's Murphy speaking at Tammany Hall. Rather, there's Roosevelt speaking at Murphy's side in 1917 at Tammany Hall. There's Roosevelt supporting Al Smith for governor, a Tammany man, in 1918. they say, well, of course, Roosevelt had to do this because it was the only way he was going to get ahead in New York politics was to make his peace with Tammany. And that is true. But I make the argument that it was more than that. I think he concluded that Tammany was now on the correct side of history, and that the Tammany of 1905 was not the same Tammany in a good way that it was in 1920, and it was producing people like Al Smith and Robert Wagner. So I think he saw a common interest in modern liberal politics between his viewpoint and Tammany's. And, you know, that's not, again, that's not a particularly common viewpoint, particularly in the Roosevelt canon.
Yeah. Well, I know that James Farley's, who was boss of Tammany at the time and FDR's patron, his biographer makes the same point, that Farley, who later turns against the New Deal like Smith, was actually a very important behind-the-scenes architect of the New Deal.
Yep. As you said, I mean, there was no greater architect of the New Deal than in terms of legislation than Robert Wagner. And Robert Wagner was, never lost his loyalty to Tammany Hall. To look at it this way, when you consider what most people think of Tammany Hall, if you were to tell them, do you know it was a Tammany guy who got Social Security passed? It was a Tammany guy who got the Wagner Act passed. It was a Tammany guy who got the first federal housing legislation passed. People would say, well, wait a minute, how is that possible? How could a Tammany guy? I thought they were evil. Well, you know what? Maybe the picture is more complicated than you think.
Yeah. Well, speaking of famous Democratic liberals who had a soft spot for Tammany, I think if Daniel Patrick Moynihan was around today, that he would delight in reading this book.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah. I think I know him well enough by now to say that with some authority. Well, so we've already taken up a lot of your time here. Why don't you end the interview by telling us about what you're working on now?
Well, right now I have my fingers crossed. I'm working on a book proposal that would sort of be a follow-up to this, but take it more broadly, looking at the Democratic Party during the early 20th century. And it's probably about as specific as I can get, because beyond that, I don't really have much more to say.
Well, it sounds interesting. I look forward to reading it. And thank you so much for talking to us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.